Welcome back to The Hemingway List, the podcast where we go from Hemingway Zero to Hemingway Hero in 16 books flat. Today we're reading Chapter 2 of The Blue Hotel by Stephen Crane, but first let's discuss Chapter 1, the questions I asked. They weren't very good questions. They were a little bit uninspired. I think I struggled to come up with something good yesterday. The first question was, who do you think is the main character? I asked this because it's not entirely clear, and also secondly because the previous book we read, The Open Boat, was funny in that it sort of didn't reveal who the main character was until the end, the last chapter of the book. And it was really cleverly done that it was slowly revealed who was the main character. So I thought, being that it's not clear who's the main character in this one, maybe he's doing the same sort of thing. The second question I threw into the Reddit subreddit is, how does the prose style compare to The Open Boat? And the third question, what was your favourite line of this chapter? Not extremely thought-provoking questions, but I kind of drew a blank. Another question that I threw out was, is anyone getting a three men walked into a bar vibe? I think I thought that because quite literally three men do walk into a bar. And secondly, because those three men and all the characters, I think so far, it's been very carefully, like Crane has been quite particular in pointing out their ethnicities and where they're from, which is, you know, how all those three men walked into a bar sort of thing. One was an Italian, one was an Irishman, you know how they go. Anyway, that was more just a little joke than anything. Not a funny one, but yeah. Techrific said, three men walked into a bar. I did get that vibe. Well, hey, at least it wasn't just me. Thank you, Techrific, for agreeing. Also, which was not immediately the case in The Open Boat, this story, without any shadow of a doubt, puts us squarely in the US of A. There's an oldie Western tone and vibe going on here, and so much seems to happen at the same time that I feel slightly shell-shocked by the noise, people, and the hustling hotel manager that seem all kinds of shady. That guy seems to be the main character for the time being, and Crane managed to make me curious about him with a few select sentences. I was drawn to the Swede, for obvious reasons, mainly that I am one myself, and I found the remark about the Swede barely touching the water interesting. Swedes had a bad reputation during this time period, and a slur about them at the time was that they were filthy. How times change, and not at all. Now there's another people getting the same kind of treatment. However, all in all, I don't think the Swede is portrayed very negatively here. Perhaps he just didn't look like the look of that water, eh? Gravel on Mud said, cold water on a cold day. It sounded unappealing to me, too. Lipstick Singularity said, I interpreted it to mean that he wasn't as tough as the others, rather than dirtier. But then again, surely Swedes are more used to the cold than Americans. Interesting. I it might be just a personal preference of the character. He didn't want to dip his hand in cold water. Also, was that cold water, everyone else had dipped their hands in it too, so maybe it was like a germ sort of thing? Like he was a cleaner person? It's kind of unclear. Right Way Up said, the first part of the chapter made me think of a Wes Anderson movie. Yeah, absolutely. I can totally see that. Not just the hotel part, but all the thoughts going into the visuals with a colour not being similar to anything else. The next part made me think of The Hateful Eight. Again, yeah, I can see that too. My favourite line was, one was a little silent man from the east who didn't look it and didn't announce it. Throws bricks at trains, said, portions of this introductory chapter felt almost like the introduction narrative in the Grand Budapest Hotel to me. I definitely agree with the Wes Anderson feelings. Yep, totally agree. Now that I've read that, I kind of can't unsee it. And even the quirkiness of that hotel porter or the owner, whoever it was very Wes Anderson. I could see him as a comedic Wes Anderson character. Lipstick Singularity said, I can see that. When I was reading, I felt like it had a real Coen Brothers feel. I could almost see an establishing shot from far away, planes stretching on in both directions, and a little bright blue hotel on the horizon, like Fargo. Yep. I'm seeing all this. In fact, now I want to see this story made into a film, or a short film. It probably already has been. Swim said, the Mama Fishy said, this story is set in the state of Nebraska, which lies in the Great Plains. A blue building would really stick out. My favourite line was, they reflected in the silence of experienced men amid new people, i.e. reading the room. So when the Swede made his statement out of nowhere, it disconcerted me and apparently the characters in the book as well. Crane's prose describing this Nebraska town is so vivid, I could see it in my mind's eye, although it is probably helpful. I've driven through this state several times over the years. And no, I didn't get the same vibe as you. Swim said, the Mama Fishy did not get the three men walked into a bar vibe. Fair enough. Waraka Akbar said, so far it seems like Scully is the main character, though we have several colourful contenders, the Swede, the cowboy and the farmer. Could Crane be setting up an allegorical story about the West? I am feeling deja vu with the prose. Crane, again, is straight to the point with this narrative. Three unnamed men cram into a small enclosure, this time a blue-painted hotel in Nebraska. Rather than fixating on the sea, Crane describes in detail the finery of the hotel, the displayed delights of the exterior of the hotel, in which a stove is humming with godlike violence. Yeah, I think it's fair to say now that Crane treats his settings, the story's settings, as a character in the book. He does such a great job of, you know, it's almost like a setting-driven piece in both cases, and that's one telling detail, is that both of these stories are named for their setting, The Open Boat and The Blue Hotel. Waraka Akbar continued, the stove is humming with godlike violence. I love that line. It's strangely foreboding for what seems a quiet Nebraskan hotel. The final lines of the chapter are also strange. Finally, with a laugh and a wink, the Swede said that some of these Western communities were very dangerous, and after his statement, he straightened his legs under the table, tilted his head, and again laughed loudly. It was plain that the demonstration had no meaning to the others. They looked at him and wondered in silence. So if this doesn't turn out to be an allegory about the West, my second guess is a grisly slasher story. C. Skull said, I got the slasher vibe too. I definitely didn't get a slasher vibe. I've got to be honest here and confess that I think some of this went over my head a little bit. There was references to the East and the West, and I wasn't sure if they were meaning like countries or the East of America and the West of America. So that all confused me a little bit. And also that whole last passage, the bit with the laugh and the wink, and he says something about Western communities, and he tilts his head and laughs, and the demonstration had no meaning to the others, and they looked and wondered in silence. I don't know what's exactly happening there. I think what's happening is he's making a joke about, you know, the West, the Western Plains, about this sort of town, because he's from the East, he's from New York. So he's making a joke about that, and the locals who are from there just sort of watch him sort of confused because he's having a good old laugh about, well, about them, essentially. But I was kind of, I suppose, guessing a little bit. I was filling in some blanks there because I wasn't 100% sure. Throws Bricks at Trains said, I agree with user Waraka Akbar that the line describing the center place of the stove is really fantastic. Interesting way to describe what I would think of as a welcoming fire in an ominous light. Yeah, saying it was humming with godlike violence is pretty ominous. The intro descriptions of the three men is probably my favorite, though. I love how balanced the difference is between their characteristics. One was a shaky and quick-eyed Swede with a great shining cheap valise. One was a tall bronzed cowboy who was on his way to a ranch near Dakota Line, and one was a little silent man from the east who didn't look it and didn't announce it. Befalgren said, "Who do you think is the main character? There's been a definite focus on the Swede so far." By the way, user Befalgren, that special Patreon flair on your comment looks pretty cool. Thank you for being a Patreon subscriber. How does the prose style compare to the open boat? Befalgren said, "It's a bit more playful, maybe because it's a work of fiction." Could be, actually, yeah. It's kind of easy to forget that The Open Boat was non-fiction. It was such a good and surreal narrative. And what was your favourite line of this chapter? It seemed to be merely a proper temple for an enormous stove, which in the centre was humming with godlike violence. Laurie Stitch said, "I think it started out with the hotel manager as the main character, but switched to the Swede at the end. I agree it's more playful, but also more ominous." Wasm said, "Interesting that as you enter the hotel, you're faced with a roaring stove, but then are given a tub of cold water. You'd think, with all the finest of the hotel, the water would at least be tepid." The last line from the Swede sounds a bit ominous, like we might expect something bad to happen. I like the line, "With this opulence and splendour, these creeds, classes, egotisms that steamed through Romper on the rails day after day, they had no colour in common." Kind of reminds me of those small towns that are very proud of whatever the local tourist attraction is. Hales 101 said, "I also found the line from the Swede ominous. I felt like if the place is shady, he is either going to find out first and get the first blow, or figure it out and everyone is going to find him crazy and not believe him until it's too late. I am probably thinking way out in the left field, though." All right. Well, I think, I don't think I've got anything to add to that. I really liked this opening chapter, but the feeling that it gave me at the end was, I want to read on, because it raised a lot of questions, and it set a lot of, set the scene, right? And set up the characters, set up the players, set up the place. And just really the feeling I had was, I want to keep reading. So I think with that being said, let's keep reading. Let's move on to chapter 2 of The Blue Hotel by Stephen Crane. As the men trooped heavily back into the front room, the two little windows presented views of a turmoiling sea of snow. The huge arms of the wind were making attempts, mighty, circular, futile, to embrace the flakes as they sped. A gatepost, like a still man with a blanched face, stood aghast amid this profligate fury. In a hearty voice, Scully announced the presence of a blizzard. The guests of the Blue Hotel, lighting their pipes, assented with grunts of lazy masculine contentment. No island of the sea could be exempt in the degree of this little room with its humming stove. Johnny, son of Scully, in a tone which defined his opinion of his ability as a card player, challenged the old farmer of both grey and sandy whiskers to a game of high five. The farmer agreed with a contemptuous and bitter scoff. They sat close to the stove and squared their knees under the wide board. The cowboy and the Easterner watched the game with interest. The Swede remained near the window, aloof, but with a countenance that showed signs of an inexplicable excitement. The play of Johnny and the grey beard was suddenly ended by another quarrel. The old man arose while casting a look of heated scorn at his adversary. He slowly buttoned his coat and then stalked with fabulous dignity from the room. In the discreet silence of all other men, the Swede laughed. His laughter rang somehow childish. Men by this time had begun to look at him askance as if they wished to inquire what ailed him. A new game was formed jocosely. The cowboy volunteered to become the partner of Johnny, and they all turned to ask the Swede to throw in his lot with the little Easterner. He asked some questions about the game, and learning that it wore many names and that he had played it when it was under an alias, he accepted the invitation. He strode towards the men nervously as if he expected to be assaulted. Finally seated, he gazed from face to face and laughed shrilly. This laugh was so strange that the Easterner looked up quickly. The cowboy sat intent and with his mouth open, and Johnny paused, holding the cards with still fingers. Afterwards there was a short silence. Then Johnny said, "Well, let's get at it. Come on now." They pulled their chairs forward until their knees were bunched under the board. They began to play, and their interest in the game caused the others to forget the manner of the Swede. The cowboy was a board whacker. Each time that he held superior cards, he whanged them one by one, with exceeding force, down upon the impoverished table, and took the tricks with a glowing air of prowess and pride that sent thrills of indignation into the heart of his opponents. A game with a board whacker in it is sure to become intense. The countenances of the Easterner and the Swede were miserable whenever the cowboy thundered down his aces and kings, while Johnny, his eyes gleaming with joy, chuckled and chuckled. Because of the absorbing play, none considered the strange ways of the Swede. They paid strict heed to the game. Finally, during a lull caused by a new deal, the Swede suddenly addressed Johnny. "I suppose there have been a good many men killed in this room." The jaws of the others dropped, and they looked at him. "What in hell are you talking about?" said Johnny. The Swede laughed again, his blatant laugh, full of a kind of false courage and defiance. "Oh, you know what I mean, all right," he answered. "I'm a liar if I do," Johnny protested. The card was halted, and the men stared at the Swede. Johnny evidently felt that as the son of the proprietor, he should make a direct inquiry. "Now, what might you be driving at, mister?" he asked. The Swede winked at him. It was a wink full of cunning. His fingers shook on the edge of the board. "Oh, maybe you think I have been to nowheres. Maybe you think I'm a tenderfoot." "I don't know nothing about you," answered Johnny, "and I don't give a darn where you've been. All I've got to say is that I don't know what you're driving at. There ain't never been nobody killed in this room." The cowboy, who had been steadily gazing at the Swede, then spoke. "What's wrong with you, mister?" Apparently it seemed to the Swede that he was formidably menaced. He shivered and turned white near the corners of his mouth. He sent an appealing glance in the direction of the little Easterner. During these moments he did not forget to wear his air of advanced pot velour. "They say they don't know what I mean," he remarked mockingly to the Easterner. The latter answered after prolonged and cautious reflection. "I don't understand you," he said impassively. The Swede made a movement then which announced that he thought he had encountered treachery from the only quarter where he had expected sympathy, if not help. "Oh, I see you are all against me, I see." The cowboy was in a state of deep stupefaction. "Say," he cried, as he tumbled the deck violently down upon the board, "say, what are you getting at, hey?" The Swede sprang up with the celerity of a man escaping from a snake on the floor. "I don't want to fight," he shouted. "I don't want to fight." The cowboy stretched his long legs indolently and deliberately. His hands were in his pockets. He spat into the sawdust box. "Well, who the hell thought you did?" he inquired. The Swede backed rapidly towards a corner of the room. His hands were out protectingly in front of his chest, but he was making an obvious struggle to control his fright. "Gentlemen," he quavered, "I suppose I am going to be killed before I can leave this house. I suppose I am going to be killed before I can leave this house." In his eyes was the dying swan look. Through the windows could be seen the snow turning blue in the shadow of dusk. The wind tore at the house, and some loose thing beat regularly against the clapboards like a spirit tapping. A door opened, and Scully himself entered. He paused in surprise as he noted the tragic attitude of the Swede. Then he said, "What's the matter here?" The Swede answered him swiftly and eagerly, "These men are going to kill me." "Kill you?" ejaculated Scully. "Kill you? What are you talking?" The Swede made the gesture of a martyr. Scully wheeled sternly upon his son. "What is this, Johnny?" The lad had grown sullen. "Damned if I know," he answered. "I can't make no sense to it." He began to shuffle the cards, fluttering them together with an angry snap. "He says a good many men have been killed in this room, or something like that, and he says he's going to be killed here too. I don't know what ails him, he's crazy. I shouldn't wonder." Scully then looked for explanation to the cowboy, but the cowboy simply shrugged his shoulders. "Kill you?" said Scully again to the Swede. "Kill you? Man, you're off your nut." "Oh, I know," burst out the Swede. "I know what will happen, yes. I'm crazy, yes. Yes, of course, I'm crazy, yes. But I know one thing." There was a sort of sweat of misery and terror upon his face. "I know I won't get out of here alive." The cowboy drew a deep breath as if his mind was passing into the last stages of dissolution. "Well, I'm doggoned," he whispered to himself. Scully wheeled suddenly and faced his son. "You've been troubling this man." Johnny's voice was loud with its burden of grievance. "Why, good God, I ain't done nothing to him." The Swede broke in. "Gentlemen, do not disturb yourselves. I will leave this house. I will go away because," he accused them dramatically with his glance, "because I don't want to be killed." Scully was furious with his son. "Will you tell me what is the matter, you young devil? What's the matter, anyhow? Speak out." "Blame it," cried Johnny in despair. "Don't I tell you I don't know? He says we want to kill him, and that's all I know. I can't tell what ails him." The Swede continued to repeat, "Never mind, Mr. Scully, never mind. I will leave this house. I will go away because I do not wish to be killed. Yes, of course, I am crazy, yes, but I know one thing. I will go away. I will leave this house. Never mind, Mr. Scully, never mind. I will go away." "You will not go away," said Scully. "You will not go away until I hear the reason of this business. If anybody has troubled you, I will take care of him. This is my house. You are under my roof, and I will not allow any peaceable man to be troubled here." He cast a terrible eye on Johnny, the cowboy, and the Easterner. "Never mind, Mr. Scully, never mind. I will go away. I do not wish to be killed." The Swede moved towards the door, which opened upon the stairs. It was evidently his intention to go at once for his baggage. "No, no," shouted Scully peremptorily. But the white-faced man slid by him and disappeared. "Now," said Scully severely, "what does this mean? Johnny and the cowboy cried together. "Why, we didn't do nothing to him." Scully's eyes were cold. "No," he said, "you didn't." Johnny swore a deep oath. "Why, this is the wildest loon I ever seen. We didn't do nothing at all. We were just sitting here playing cards, and he..." The father suddenly spoke to the Easterner. "Mr. Blanc," he asked, "what has these boys been doing?" The Easterner reflected again. "I didn't see anything wrong at all," he said, at last, slowly. Scully began to howl. "But what does this mean?" He stared ferociously at his son. "I have a mind to lather you for this, my boy." Johnny was frantic. "Well, what have I done?" he bawled at his father. All right, there we go. The second chapter, down. That was really great. I loved that chapter. Such great dialogue, and I love that the action is unfolding via dialogue. So cool. That was some of the most entertaining reading I've done in a long time. I can't wait to read you guys' comments about this chapter. Head over to the subreddit, reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. Have your say about this chapter, chapter 2 of The Blue Hotel. If you would like to support the creation of this podcast, you can head over to patreon.com/thehemingwaylist. You can choose whatever value you would like to support the podcast for. It's a monthly subscription, so you can choose $1 a month, and you'll be getting 30 episodes for $1. You can also subscribe for as long or as little as you like. You can unsubscribe at any point. That helps to support the creation of this podcast, so it's very much appreciated. You can also get the official paperbacks of the Hemingway list. The first two are available. These Stephen Crane stories, and also Dubliners by James Joyce. Head to thehemingwaylist.com and look for the link that says Our Official Paperbacks. We will be having the third one come out soon, probably within a week or so, because we are going to be starting reading that on the 5th of February, which is not too far away. I'm going to leave the voting open on what that fourth book will be. We're currently voting on that. Head to the subreddit to find the details about that vote if you want to have your say. I'm going to announce the fourth book in the next day or two. Other than that, thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.